Hello, I'm Kelly Gardner, and you're listening to Imagining the Past. Imagining the Past is a sneak preview of some of the writers and issues showcased in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Parramatta, New South Wales, from the 25th to the 27th of October 2019, the conference offers craft workshops and 2 days of panel sessions, interviews and conversations. It's for writers and readers of historical fiction. You'll hear from a huge range of authors: Jackie French, Paula Morris, Anna Campbell, Pamela Hart, Ali Elizadeh, Meg Keneally, Kate Forsyth, and many more. The weekend also features academic panels and demonstrations of historical weapons. You can find out more at hnsa.org.au. In this podcast series, I'll be talking to some of our conference guests about writing and reading historical fiction. David Wish Wilson was born in Newcastle, New South Wales, but grew up in Singapore, Victoria, and Western Australia. He left Australia aged 18 to live for a decade in Europe, Africa, and Asia. He's the author of The Summons, many short stories, and is best known for his trilogy of crime novels featuring Frank Swan, Line of Sight, Zero at the Bone, and Old Scores. His non-fiction book Perth, part of the New South Books City series, was shortlisted for a Western Australian Premier's Book Award. His latest novel is The Coves, set in San Francisco in the wild gold rush of 1849. I spoke to David on the phone from Fremantle, where he coordinates the creative writing program at Curtin University. Welcome to the Imagining the Past podcast.
Thanks, Kelly. Good to be here.
So, David, you're well known for crime writing set in the recent past, but you've also written novels set in Nazi Germany and now in the gold rushes of the American West. What is it about stories from history that draw you in?
Yeah, it's usually just something very small, just a little nugget of something that catches my interest and doesn't let go. So with my most recent historical novel, The Coves, a friend of mine asked me, as a crime writer, he asked me if I'd heard of this group of Australian criminals who kind of took over San Francisco in its early first 5 or 6 years, and I hadn't, and that was interesting enough. And I went and I looked at, I did a bit of exploring, and they were a pretty interesting bunch of characters. There wasn't much written about them on the surface of it, and that was interesting too. What really kind of, you know, piqued my interest when I dug a little deeper was not so much the people involved or even their criminality or even the fact that they were so influential in early San Francisco, but the fact that a lot of those people then came back to Australia and participated in the Australian gold rushes and then the New Zealand gold rushes and then the Queensland gold rush and so on and so forth. And it's a, kind of the social changes they were able to bring just by weight of numbers and the fact that they created this roving, seemingly chaotic but kind of egalitarian culture influenced by American politics and what have you. So often it's just a small, might be a character, a character's name, and then the more I dig, obviously, the more interesting these things become. My current work in progress, which I'm only about halfway through, started with a story I discovered when I was in San Francisco about an Irish convict. You know, he was sentenced, he was Irish, but he grew up in East London in Whitechapel. At the age of 14, he was sentenced to 14 years hard labour in Australia. He was a bit of a rogue in Australia. He kept escaping. He kept getting punished. It's pretty terrible, really, what happened to him. And then he escaped to America on a whaling ship, and he became quite an influential character in New York society, or certainly in the New York underworld. He ultimately died in a San Franciscan prison cell. So his life story was interesting, principally because just about everything you've known about him I've since discovered through research is actually not true. Some of that was deception that he'd created to deflect the fact that he was an escaped convict, and others was just kind of myth-making by the American media. But again, the thing that really made me want to write about him was not the fact that this was quite an interesting untold story, but the fact that as he was dying, his wife confided that he'd always been a melancholic. So it was, again, just an aspect of character which you wouldn't think looking at the surface of his life. He just looks like a guy who's been brutalised and has become brutal himself. and yet quietly behind the scenes, he's vulnerable. So that small things like that is what gets me interested and involved.
So it's the people's stories rather than the era, it sounds to me, that those little insights into character that intrigue you.
Yeah, it's all about people. I mean, writing to me is all about character. Story for me emerges from character. I never start with a plot. It always just starts with a few characters, and then the story develops out of there. But, you know, I think it's interesting, the fact that genetically we haven't really changed for the last 100,000 years. Our circumstances have changed, our societies have changed, but we're really the same kind of people, dealing with life in the same kind of way. So it is always character that draws me to a story and makes me want to dig a little bit deeper and then write about that person and how they, or a series of people, and how they dealt with or coped with their kind of society. So, for example, the main character of The Coves is a 12-year-old boy. I've never written from the perspective of a child character before, but you know, I did it for a couple of reasons. I knew that when I was writing The Coves, I didn't want to write a big novel. I wanted to write something small and intimate with just a few characters. And it seemed to me that, I've got children of my own. I'm fascinated by the way children look at the world and the way that they experience time, unlike us adults who are always busy all the time and we're always thinking of the next thing we've got to do, and so we're kind of displaced from the moment. We're displaced from time, and as a result, time moves faster. Because San Francisco in its first few years was such a crazy, chaotic place, I wanted that quiet child's perspective with time moving very slowly to be the quiet centre of the story amidst all of this craziness and chaos going on around him. And then there were other strategic reasons, because you can have things explained to a child in dialogue, which removes the need for exposition and all of that kind of thing. So, yeah, it is always character.
So let's talk a little bit about Sam, because he's escaped from Van Diemen's Land. He's only 12 years old at the start of the story, in this situation where he has to survive in what was initially that sort of feels like a chaotic, lawless mutiny situation, really, isn't it? Piracy, and then further into the what you're describing there is still chaotic San Francisco. And he does that by telling them his life story, and they're kind of second guessing him and trying to work it out, and he's doing it to survive. He's thinking fast. So I guess one of the things that intrigued me about it is the voices that you've created for him and for the narrative voice and for those people, those really tough men around him. How do you balance that 19th century, or sort of recreating that 19th century voice, or many different voices, because some of them are convicts, some of them got different, they call him his sort of silver spoon accent, with the expectations of the modern reader. What's at play there in that decisions about voice that you make?
Well, I suppose the first decision I made was a rather selfish one, when I knew that I wanted to write about the story. And most of my crime fiction, as you said, is set in 1970s, 1980s, Perth, Fremantle, Western Australia, and it's kind of classic crime noir. It's the language is very spare and sparse. It's dialogue driven. What I wanted to do by writing about a 19th century narrative was to just loosen the shackles for a bit and have a bit of fun and write in a style that allows for a little bit more freedom and a little bit more rhythm. And it seemed to me that English, certainly in the 19th century, all languages, of course, are always evolving all the time. But 19th century English, it was a period where not many people were literate in terms of reading and writing. There were many different dialects. There were newly colonial countries like Australia and the United States, where language was evolving very fast, collisions of all different kinds of cultures. And I wanted to kind of capture that kind of spirit of freedom and change on the page. I mean, realistically, I wasn't able to do that by reading 19th century literature, because a lot of that was written for the standard kind of middle class reader, written in the form of standard English. There are some kind of exceptions, like Melville and others, but my main source for the language was the Old Bailey online. Mm. I don't know if you've read that.
Yes, I have. It's fascinating, isn't it?
It is fascinating.
And you can hear people's real voices coming through in the testimony.
Yeah, you can hear real people. That's right. So, you know, there were a lot of native Irish speakers around at the time. There was Scottish Gaelic speakers around at the time. English was, for many people, a second language. It was interesting, not so much on the Old Bailey and Lyne, but there I was able to find the kind of English, spoken English as transcribed, that ordinary people spoke, and that's the kind of language I wanted to use in the story. So that was my main kind of resource. I would kind of read a lot of the old trials from around the period, and hopefully they were faithfully transcribed. And it seemed to me some of the characters I was researching were. And then it was just a matter of, obviously, a writer writing in the 21st century it's only ever going to be an approximation. You wouldn't pretend to actually capture genuine speech of the period. But so it's an attempt. It was one that I enjoyed using a great deal. It was an attempt to kind of capture the interesting fact that English was very fluid at the time as well. There was lots of slang. There were lots of different kind of dialects, criminal argo, formal English, Irish English, Scottish English, Australian English, American English, lots of different Englishes all happening at the same time in the same place.
I saw one reviewer said that The Coves was a story in which Australian criminals take over the TV series Deadwood. Is that the kind of feel you had in mind?
The kind of story? Or
The kind of feel. Deadwood goes the full sort of Shakespearean language,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Not necessarily. I mean, I love Deadwood, and I love the monologues. But, yeah, again, that's an approximation, and it's a fabrication of a kind of English that was spoken. So I certainly didn't want it to be mannered is not the right word, because I actually love those soliloquies in Deadwood. But it seemed to me that San Francisco at the time was very much like Deadwood. It was a city being built from the ground up. There were lots of people from all different kind of cultures, and it was largely a lawless place. I think to give an illustration of the way different governments controlled things like the gold rushes. In Australia, I believe when the gold rush happened in Victoria, I think in Ballarat, there were 23,000 miners and there were 2,300 policemen and soldiers, so one for every 10 miner. I think in California, in a place like San Francisco, with a population of 30,000, there was 20 policemen, and they were all easily bribed, from what I gather. So it was a place where people, as long as they didn't push things too far, and of course many of these Australians did, they were able to create their own kind of societies. They were able to create their own kind of self-governing societies and laws. And Deadwood is very much like that as well.
So I'm wondering about is it a fascination with criminality, and that in this book, where people are able to make their own laws and create their own societies, but they're also in a sense outside the law, and there's a lot of lawlessness as well. Would you describe it as a crime book? Is it crime fiction?
I think it's certainly got some crime elements. I mean, I one of the great things about using a crime fiction structure is the narrative has an inbuilt kind of sense of suspense or tension. This is less the traditional kind of story. It's more what you would call a crime novel as opposed to a detective novel. Mm-hmm. It's about putting a character in danger and seeing how he or she survives or gets out of it. I mean, I'm interested in crime because I've used it as I suppose my main influence when I started writing crime fiction was a friend and a colleague of mine, the West Australian Noongar writer Kim Scott, in the way in his early career he kind of wrote into the silences in the historical record to do with, Indigenous subjectivities and stories, things that have been kind of kept quiet. And that to me was an interesting approach. And because there were so many West Australian crime stories, which, again, had been silenced for various reasons. It's a very long story, but my first crime novels were all about bringing some of these stories out into the light. They're a mix of fact and fiction, looking, I suppose, at that intersection of criminal behaviour or underworld criminal behaviour and where that meets with business and politics, which is certainly a very ripe area or fertile area in Western Australia, and yet none of these stories had ever really been told. They're not the kind of stories you find in history books, there was an enforced silence around these kinds of things. And what interests me about crime fiction is it's a very good means, hopefully it's an entertaining read, suspenseful and all of that kind of, but what interests me philosophically about it is it's a great medium, I suppose, for looking behind the kind of comforting myths and stories we tell ourselves as individuals and also as society. I mean, we all like to think of ourselves as good and generous people, but it's not really until we're placed in a situation where those personal values and personal things we believe about ourselves are placed under stress that we actually learn who we really are. And similarly, as you know, societies tell stories about themselves. Australia is a great example. Crime fiction is a good way of looking behind these kinds of stories. So that's what attracts me to crime fiction. I've been able to use it as a medium to kind of bring out some of the stories around Western Australia that are true to this place. And I guess in the Cove, it's a little bit like that. It's more focused on Sam Bellamy. What interested me about him was the fact that it was such a crazy and chaotic time. The Americans had a slang term for the Australians, and that was hard citizens, because they were a little bit older and many of them had done hard labour, as opposed to the average American who turned up in California around at that time. They were described by Mark Twain as being the flower of American youth. They were young and they were naive and they were had a spirit of adventure, as opposed to these quite hardened Australians who were able to kind of take things over because they were a little bit more ruthless and sometimes a little bit more canny as well. And yet amongst that, you have a kid like Sam Bellamy, who is, I've kind of based him on one of my children, who actually asked me to write a book about him. And when I said I couldn't do that, he said, can you write a book about a boy like me? And that's how
Sam was born.
That's how Sam was born. So it interests me how, I mean, quite shy, gentle children have always been around, and yet how do they survive in this kind of society? The story, you know, amongst all of the other goings on, is really about how, some of the violence and some of the chaos going around really kind of foregrounds the considerable kindness, I suppose you'd call it, that Sam receives from some unexpected quarters. You know, he's befriended, he's taken under the wing as an older man and a couple of other people. So it's really about how Sam tries to stay true to himself amongst all of this violence and chaos, how he figures out a way to not just survive but also make his way in the world, I suppose, without turning himself into a brute, despite all the brutality. Again, that goes back to my interest in behaviour as an aspect of crime fiction as a medium of looking at that kind of thing. How do people stay true to themselves when they're placed in stressful situations? Because crime fiction, after all, is it's a great medium for looking at people in extreme positions.
So Sam is wholly invented, is he?
Sam is wholly invented.
Yeah, but you've put him in this world with these people who are either real people or based on real people, based on a real situation. How do you decide, or do you decide? Do you just, perhaps it's just intuitive, that the mixture between fact, documented fact, real people's lives, and the imagined in your books?
Yeah, it's that's a good one. I mean, it's largely intuitive. I mean, I usually start off with just a couple of characters and zero plot, and I usually run a kind of a braided narrative where the story is told from the perspective of a few different characters. What I do want, I mean, I believe in fiction as a medium for telling the truth, even if paradoxically sometimes you're using invented characters and invented situations to approach that. I mean, I've always liked that Flannery O'Connor line where she said that in her work the truth isn't distorted, but distortion is used to get at the truth.
Hmm.
So sometimes amalgamating several real life characters and turning them into a semi fictional character is the right way to go. I want the story to capture some of the reality of the situation, and sometimes creating a fictional character is the right way to do that. Sometimes condensing periods of time, sometimes inventing aspects of the plot seems to me a more truthful way of going about it than just genuinely representing what happened in what order and what, over what kind of period of time.
Do you always start then from some kernel of truth, some documented case, a story that you hear about real people that you then go and investigate? Are all of your books based on that kernel of truth or documented event?
Yeah, the majority of them are, yeah. So I think it's only really my next two crime novels. There's one coming out in November and another one next year, which I have largely invented. My first three crime novels, because I was using crime fiction as a vehicle to explore these aspects of Western Australian history that haven't really been able to be rendered in any other way, I would start with a story. So the first one was about, I was a creative writing teacher at Casuarina Prison, which is our maximum security prison. I did that for a few years and I got to know one particular inmate. He became a good friend of mine. It's a very notorious crime story over here in Western Australia. It was the murder of a brothel madam whose name was Shirley Finn. And the rumours were always around that she was murdered by detectives, and that was actually the case. And several journalists over the brave journalists over the years had had a stab at trying to bring this story out into the light, and I had a stab at writing it as a non-fiction story as well. And the problem, of course, when you're dealing with a subject like that where there's genuine physical danger involved, is people are very unwilling to talk on the record. And one day, just intuitively, I said to this person who was not being as forthcoming as I'd hoped, even though I knew they knew certain things, I just on the spot decided, I said, look, I'm going to write the story as a novel. I'm not going to write it as a non-fiction story. Just tell me your stories. I'm not going to record anything. Nothing's on the record. And once I did that, I found people were very forthcoming, very willing to tell their stories. And I just kind of triangulated these stories until I'd kind of worked out what had happened. And my first crime novel, Line of Sight, was based on that. And that's probably one of the hardest stories, strangely enough, I've had to write, because I felt like I was writing for my friend Shane Finn, and so I had a responsibility to keep to as close to the truth as I possibly could. Whereas I naturally, by temperament, want to fiction write. I want to make things up. I'm principally a fiction writer. What I did in writing that novel, I'd gone out and I'd interviewed somewhere between 100 and 120 people. I found that there was this incredible raft of stories in Perth and Fremantle in the 70s and 80s that had never been told before, and they were fascinating to me. So I thought, well, I'll just take a couple of these stories with the people's permission, and I'll just start to build crime narratives out of these, looking, I guess, from the underneath at the way things really worked in that period. So I start with a true story, and then I build a largely fictional fabric around them. Hopefully, it's fictional fabric, which it doesn't ever move away from the truth. It kind of illustrates or illuminates the truth behind the situation.
And what about when you write non-fiction, like you've written the book Perth, which draws on history it's like a biography of place, really, I guess. So is there a difference in how you approach writing or researching non-fiction projects? What do you do differently?
I think my crime fiction research is possibly my favourite kind of research, because it involves, as I just mentioned, talking to people. It's crime fiction set in the recent past, so a lot of these people are alive. So I'm able to go out and talk to people. You find the odd newspaper article, that kind of thing, or court documents. But for my non-fiction work, it's largely text-based. It's also good fun. I mean, I love spending time in the archives. I love discovering stories that way. So with that Perth book, which is kind of, as you said correctly, it's a biography of place. It's a kind of love letter to the city that I grew up in and love. I do this with all the nonfiction work. I just immersed myself in the material. I watched every film, read every poem, listened to every song that had ever been written about this place, read every novel set in Perth. And once I reached that slightly mentally exhausting state of total immersion, then I sit down and write, and things proceed largely intuitively from there. Well, that was a particularly crazy book to write, because I think I had 130 books scattered around my room, and I've never been very organised. So trying to find the quote, which I knew is in that book, I'd be running from my computer to a book and then back to my computer. It was a strangely physically active book to write.
And what about for The Coves or a book like that you mentioned, the reading the transcripts from the Old Bailey? What's your kind of research process for something set in that more distant past?
So it started, I did as much as I could over here. There's not a lot available online about this group of people. The looking at the Old Bailey album was really just an attempt to capture some kind of authenticity voice. But I was lucky enough to be able to travel to San Francisco quite early on, and I still wasn't sure that I was going to write the story then. But I went to the San Francisco Public Library, and I'd arrived the day before, actually, and I was a little bit jet-lagged, and I walked around this area, which I knew used to be called Sydney Town or Australia Town. It's quite a large part of San Francisco. And there were plaques, you know, it later became the Beatnik area, and that, you know, there were plaques to Ginsberg and plaques to different parts of history when it was known as the Barbary Coast. But there's absolutely nothing about the Australian presence, which I found quite intriguing. When I got to the San Francisco Public Library the next day, I was very, very, very lucky, because there was an elderly man on duty behind the desk, and he basically embraced me and he said, "Oh, finally someone's come to look at this story." And he said, "Sit down." And I did, and I had expected to have to spend a couple of weeks working my way through the files and looking through the vast collection they had of historical material. He said, "Look, just sit down." And he proceeded to pile books in front of me. You know, chapter 7 in this book, here's a link to these photographs, the first photographs taken of San Francisco and the first photographs taken of Australians. And he was a terrific guy to meet. And what I discovered was, because these Australians had overreached, they were blamed for burning San Francisco to the ground 5 times in its first 6 years. And I think at least a couple of those instances were true. You know, once the people started to organise themselves, and that was interesting to me as well, because whereas the British government ruling Australia was essentially a military dictatorship, people were quite under the thumb. America, in contrast to that, America's a revolutionary society, so because of these Australian depredations, nobody was going to rely on the government to kind of come to their aid, so people started organising themselves. And sadly, Australians were lynched all over the goldfields. But as soon as it looked like these Americans were organising themselves to create some vigilante group to deal with the Australians, I would light a fire at the edge of the Australian area and it would burn the rest of the city down. That would distract everyone for a good, 6 or 8 months. When the first vigilance committee was instituted in 1851, of course they kept, as is the way of these things, they kept quite studious notes, and there were lots of interviews, and that was a terrific resource because, you know, Mrs. Brown, for example, who I've just made up, who ran a brothel down on X Street. She was interviewed as to, you know, the nefarious goings on in her lodging house, and so you got to hear people speak in their voice, transcribed, of course, and gave a little bit more depth to the Australian experience at the time. And then when that vigilance committee didn't work, they had another very big one in 1855. The same thing, there are hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents, which can be, if you go in there, you can sit down and read them, and they make fascinating reading. So there was a lot written about the Australians during the time, but not a lot after. Their kind of presence was expunged, I think.
On purpose?
Yeah, there's a possibly apocryphal story of Harold Holt going to San Francisco in the 1960s, and the American mayor basically, hesitating to shake his hand and saying, "Well, I must be the first San Franciscan mayor to shake an Australian's hand for, a very long time." Something like that. So the cultural memory was there, but it hadn't been immortalised or mythologised in any kind of way.
And certainly, I mean, I don't know whether it's just my ignorance, but these are extraordinary stories that I had no sense of this story at all. So not just expunged from the San Francisco history, but also somehow expunged from our own.
Absolutely, yeah. That was, like I said, what really piqued my interest. I mean, there's a young historian, Ben Mountford, who's been writing about this group at the moment. So there's some good research there. But, yeah, it was intriguing to me that at one point, when San Francisco's population, I think, was around 25,000, one quarter of the population was considered to be Australian. And a lot of those people came back to Australia for the 1850s gold rush, and as did a lot of Californians. A lot of them would have presumably become Californians. a lot of them who, you know, had a Scottish or English or Irish background, when it became very dangerous to be known as Australian, would have just presumably said, look, I'm Scottish or I'm Irish or Australian, and kind of camouflaged themselves. But yeah, it's kind of an unknown story. It was written a little bit about in Australia only when they started hanging Australians, because the gold rush had started in Australia, and the Americans were very worried that when they came to Australia, to Victoria, to look for gold, they were going to be treated very badly. Turned out to be not the case. But there was a little bit of toing and froing between the two countries. It wasn't written a lot about, and it's never been thoroughly researched. But to me, they're quite an interesting community. Just the fact that everywhere they went, they changed things, I think, for the better, despite the fact that there was brutality, there was, environmental despoilation, there was, digging for gold is not necessarily kind on the environment. But everywhere this group went, they introduced a little bit of democracy. I mean, it happened with Eureka Stockade in Victoria when there was the first instance of male suffrage. And there's a great story in the Otago goldfields just before that happened. So one of the British were over there trying to create some lost feudal society where generals and majors from the Indian Raj could retire to South Island, New Zealand, set themselves up with a large estate and servants and all of that kind of thing. And so some of these people, they were aware that there was gold in their rivers, but they didn't want to announce it. They didn't want to tell anyone about it because they knew exactly what would happen. And some servant apparently did find gold and ride into Dunedin and announce it. And, of course, what the pseudo-aristocracy of South Island, New Zealand most feared actually came to pass. This large, crazy group of people descended on South Island, New Zealand. And during the Otago gold rushes, the same kind of thing happened. You know, they demanded social change, and they got it. There's a little bit more democracy. Quite an interesting series of histories written about that area. As far as I can see, it's the first place in Australia or New Zealand, and perhaps in the world, where homosexuality was openly practiced. A male couple could set themselves up together. There's descriptions of male couples living openly, having a little garden, going off and mining during the day, and nobody bothered about that because everybody was united by the desire to find gold. So you had moments of religious and racial tension, but largely people decided to get on with it, and they organised themselves to institute their own kind of law, and there's a sense of people leaving one another alone. So that's what interested me about this group of people. Particularly the ones that kind of came back to Australia and then moved to New Zealand and elsewhere. It seems to me some of the social democratic values that arrived in the latter part of the 19th and early 20th century Australia derived from this group of people who were actually very multicultural, way before multiculturalism became a thing in Australia. You know, there were Norwegians and there were South Americans and there were African Americans and people from Polynesia, people from all over the world, Chinese people in large numbers, and all of them pretty much getting on together and living alongside one another and intermarrying. And that seems to me a pretty important but untold story of Australian history.
So that day that you went into the public library, did you have a research plan? Did you know what you were looking for and then this librarian just completely surprised you? Or do you just kind of hope for the best? Especially when you're going somewhere like that where it's a big investment, a big trip. Are you searching for things in particular?
I mean, I'm always open to luck or happenstance. I knew that there were a couple of texts in there which weren't available online. Some of the early histories of San Francisco, very large scholarly tomes written in quite a dull style. But I hoped that they might reference the Australian experience to some extent. What I wasn't aware of was the broad range of material largely produced by this vigilance committee, again, which wasn't available online. Then there are other things which I couldn't possibly have expected, such as the photographs this librarian showed me, and I, in fact, discovered a few of my own. It turned out that the first kind of sheriff of San Francisco, who was tasked specifically to deal with these Australian rogues, he instituted, I think it was only the third place in the world, the practice of taking mugshots. So photography was obviously very new. It had been done a little bit in Paris and a little bit in New York, but this guy was arresting Australians and exiling them, taking them to the edge of town and kicking them off and telling them to go. And then, of course, they were just coming back under a different name. And he wanted a way of showing, of shopkeepers being able to recognise people. And so he started taking mugshots of these Australians, and a few of them still exist, and I was able to find them. They're fascinating. Fascinating photographs. So I wouldn't have expected something like that. And, the old cliche, a picture tells a thousand words or stories. You look in these faces, you can see the history, you can see the struggle, you can see the mischief, you can see the pride and defiance. And some of them are just quite sad. One of the most telling was of a New Zealand woman. Her name was Rose Church. And there's just the photograph and the description beneath it, which is, you know, Rose Church arrested for drugging one of her clients in the brothel she ran. The only kind of personal description was she has a strong Irish accent and very bad teeth. And then as an addendum added later, it just says, oh, she died in San Quentin prison in 1857 or something like that. So those were the kinds of things I couldn't possibly have imagined I would find. But there were lots of stories, lots of things like that, that I was only able to discover with the help of this friendly librarian who put me onto local historians. That's another important source of information for me. So I'm going to Ireland in October to research this character I'm looking at. So there's not a lot known because it was, 1813, 1814, 1815. So I'll be depending, I think, quite heavily on local historians for that to dig up a little bit, because there weren't great records kept of Irish Catholics born around that time. So that's another important one for me, is finding authoritative local historians, people who love telling stories, basically. I'm like a child when people start telling stories.
Like Sam telling the story of his life in those early chapters. So they're extraordinary resources. And so I was wondering, you teach creative writing. Have you got any particular tips or advice for people who are starting out researching and writing historical fiction?
Yeah, I think ultimately you're going to have to trust yourself. I mean, I know some people who they do the writing before they do the research, and that works for them. And mine's kind of a mix. I do the research while I'm doing the writing, as much before as I possibly can. But I know certainly for some of my students over the years who have written historical novels, that has also been, doing all the research beforehand has been, I think, fair to describe it as a paralysing kind of experience, not really knowing when to start or not really knowing, having the confidence when to leap in. So I usually advise to do as much research as you possibly can, but start writing as well straight away, knowing that you'll come back and knowing that you'll get certain things wrong, go back and correct them later. The main thing is to start the writing and stick with the writing, because, whatever genre you're working in, writing is one of those things where you work it out as you go along, and you improve your skills as you go along, and the story develops on its own as you go along. So that's usually my advice with my students who are writing historical fictions, particularly the postgrads. Immediately dive into the research, find the nuggets of truth, the kernels of interesting factoids or stories that interest you or grab hold of you, but start writing as soon as you possibly can.
Well, thank you for that very wise advice and for taking the time to talk to us today. And we look forward to talking more with you about historical fiction at the conference in October.
You're most welcome, and I look forward to meeting you all.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Imagining the Past. It's a showcase of some of the writers in this year's conference of the Historical Novel Society of Australasia. In Parramatta, New South Wales, from the 25th to 27th of October, the conference offers craft workshops and 2 days of panel sessions, interviews and conversations for writers and readers. You can find the 2019 conference program, book tickets and listen to more episodes of Imagining the Past at hnsa.org.au.